Hi there, Jonathan here. The following talk is offered freely to ensure that no one is ever denied access to these practices and to these teachings. If you feel inspired to make a donation to support this offering, you can go to my website where you can also sign up for a monthly newsletter designed to support you in your practice. That's at www.jonathanfaust.com. Thank you and enjoy. Today is Diwali. This is a festival of lights that is celebrated by millions and millions of people around the planet. It's a celebration that's celebrated by Hindus, by Jains, by Sikhs, by some Buddhists. And it takes many different forms in different traditions. But it's a celebration of knowledge and self-inquiry, self-improvement, and seeking the path. It's a metaphor for dispelling the darkness and cultivating compassion, and a celebration of the inner light over darkness and knowledge over ignorance. So we thought we would create our own little ceremony just to connect with the millions of people around the planet. So this is going to be an offering of light from both La and Sebene. And in your own way, you can just receive the light in your own way. Traditionally, hands are in prayer position, or you can just pull it in, however you want. And I'm going to offer the words in Sanskrit that are connected with this, and then offer you the translation.
Asato ma satgamaya tamaso ma jyotir gamaya mityor ma amritam gamaya Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.
From untruth, lead us to truth. From darkness, lead us to light. From death, lead us to the deathless. Om, peace, peace, peace. So you might just close your eyes for a moment. And in your own way, sense the light within you which has been nurtured and nourished. You might sense all you have done in this retreat to receive this inner light of radiant mind and heart. You might sense in your own way your willingness to receive this ever deeper and to allow this light to join with all the lights throughout this universe to fill the space with the light of wisdom, the light of compassion. Namaste. I was surprised how emotional I got. I spent a couple decades in an ashram, and every night we did arti, which is the offering of lights. So to chant those words just connected me back with a sangha for many, many years. So I'm wondering, has anything shifted in the last week for you? Do you remember how you felt when you walked in here Friday night, 6 days ago? It's natural to want to give yourself a report card as to how well you've done or how well you're doing. And I just want to say, you truly, truly cannot measure or evaluate your experience. It's simply not possible to measure it. Many years I did a month-long retreat. It was my second month-long retreat at Spirit Rock. The first retreat was filled with all kinds of revelations and insights and drama, and I was really revved up for the second one, expecting something similar. And of course, no lights, no rainbows, no fantastic takeaways. And I left not exactly let down, because it was beneficial, but not with a lot of drama. And I got quickly caught up into the busyness of my life. And it was maybe about 3 months later when Tara, my wife, said, "You know, you are a lot less anxious." And then I realized that was absolutely true. That there was some deep clench that had let go a little bit. And that was enough for me to feel I felt a greater sense of ease, that the old fears, the old demons didn't quite have the purchase they had before. So there's something here about this practice that involves a really deep letting go, of letting go of all attachment to the outcome. And I always like to quote Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. The first technique I learned was transcendental meditation. And this little saying that's so cliche, but I come back to it all the time. He would say, "You water the root and enjoy the fruit." And I've really come to trust that there's something about every time you open the non-judging awareness and you sincerely pause, you are deeply watering the root. And how can that not affect you? Some ways quite measurably, in some ways you can't measure it until later. A question that's come up a couple times recently is, what am I going to tell people when I get home? And my advice is, as little as possible. Pat always likes to say, if people ask you how your retreat was, tell them, but pay very, very careful attention to the moment their eyes start glazing over. And that may be a 3-second window you've got. Living in the ashram, I remember at the end of some intensive retreat, we were having a big satsang, and someone came up to speak to the teacher, our guru, and said, "My heart is so bursting. I just want to run home and tell my parents I love them." There was a long pause. And he said, "Don't do that." This is what he said. He said, "Just clean the basement." There it is. And that's the subject of my talk. I really, truly want to honor not just what called you here on retreat, but the fact that you came. And not only that, but the fact that you stayed. You know, some of us were called here because our suffering was so intense that we're willing to try anything. Some of us perhaps had read books about the practice and it kind of made sense rationally and you were called to the experience. For some of us, our home practice was showing some benefit, so wouldn't more be better? For some of us, we've seen other people transform through the practice, and that's sparked something inside of us. And as I mentioned earlier, maybe some of us are here because we're hiding from the authorities, which is okay too. You too are welcome. And for many of us, there's just some undeniable calling. Something inside you felt that this was next for you in your path. And I really bow to that wisdom faculty. Something has called you forward to deepen your investigation of reality. So as we've been gathering in the evenings, Law set the stage for us so beautifully and demonstrating what it means to be open and present and so beautifully undefended. And Pat spoke so beautifully of the primal energies that sometimes can feel like obstacles, but to recognize them as allies and how to work with them. Sebene spoke of cultivating ease and the immense power of an anchor and how it can hold you steady no matter what storms arise in your life. And she illustrated that with so many heartwarming examples. I talked a little bit about the foundations of awareness, of the different lenses through which we perceive. And Pat explored the theme of bridging separation, of recognizing separation in your life and how to investigate and explore what it means to bridge that separation. And tonight, I'd like to talk a little bit about what it means to be awake and in the world. And there are three particular characteristics of wakefulness I'd like to talk about. One is the recognition of self-responsibility. And one is not only the willingness, but the call to explore what's between you and feeling free. And the third is what it means to be aware of interdependence. To be aware of self and to be aware of other and to explore that relationship in your life. There's one particular story I found very helpful. And of course, what we know of the Buddha is all verbal and handed down. But ostensibly, there was a story when the Buddha was asked, how can I tell if I'm making any progress in my practice? I've certainly asked myself that. You may know that phrase to say, when you meditate, you'll feel better. Maybe you were told that. And you realize you feel your anger better, your depression better, your sadness better, as well as your capacity for joy and kindness and steadiness and equanimity and the whole thing. But he pointed to three factors. The one way to sense your progress on the path is by what degree your life is influenced or colored by greed, by hatred, and by delusion. And so it's an interesting question as you evaluate where you are as opposed to where you were 6 days ago. Is there less wanting? Is there less clutching? Is there perhaps a little less aversion, a little less blame, a little less judgment, or at least the awareness, heightened awareness of it? Is there perhaps a little bit less confusion and more of a capacity to see things as they are? inevitably, there's a question when we move from the monastery back into the marketplace. Where do I go from here? One of my favorite lines I ever ran across, it's actually two lines that I've run across, is from E.B. White. He said, "I wake up each morning torn between a desire to serve the world and to savor it. This makes it difficult to plan the day." And that quote has really informed my life, and Tara kind of took it up in our marriage vows, and constantly reminding each other, you know, are we serving and savoring to the degree that we feel called? So imagine a life where your priority, your number one priority, was to cultivate wisdom and compassion, and to your utmost ability, dedicate the fruit of your action to the benefit of all beings. That's really what you have been doing this week. And this is really the call to the bodhisattva. Bodhicitta, this awakened heart and mind, is the spontaneous desire to attain enlightenment, motivated by compassion. And with it, there's a falling away of attachment to the illusion of the existing self. Someone who has this realization, this desire to be awakened in order to serve, is called a bodhisattva. So it's interesting in that definition what it's not. It's not to fully wake up the heart and mind, clear all your karma, and then pack your bags and get the hell out of Dodge. Nor is it to first wake up the heart and mind, achieve the 10 perfections, get certified and licensed, and then go out and serve humanity. It's about being in the process of waking up and simultaneously being on a path of service. The path of service becomes your path of waking up. And so the question of waking up is a really interesting one, and Pat talked about it a little bit last night. When we talk about waking up, are we talking about some idea of like full-blown enlightenment, where greed and hatred and delusion simply have no grasp? Is that possible? Or is it just an ideal? Or maybe this is a process of relative waking up, where you get increasingly and incrementally more awake. You're less and less incrementally identified with a self that is colored by greed, hatred, and delusion. And it's interesting because in some traditions, they play down the whole idea of enlightenment, while other traditions declare that it's absolutely possible. So do we fully wake up, or is it a gradual awakening? In some traditions, as I mentioned in my talk about how exceedingly rare it is. You know, every 500 years, only one person will wake up. And I kind of imagine that as like a bunch of sperm, you know, moving toward the egg, you know, elbowing each other. Not that they have elbows, but they're competing to get to that one place because there's only one that's going to get there. That's a concept. Or maybe you just have enlightened moments. Maybe there's just these moments of non-desire, these glimpses into the mystery, the sense of no self. And maybe it's just stringing more and more of those moments together. I love the story that Pema Chodron tells. And Pema Chodron was asked by a journalist, "Well, what got you started meditating?" And she said, that's easy. I hated my husband. So that's what got her going. But she's been actively practicing for, I don't know how long now. Long time. But she said that she was always jealous of people who would talk about breakthroughs. She said, in all my years, my decades of practice, I've never had a breakthrough. But it's only when I pause and I look back over time that I can recognize how much has changed and shifted in my life. So for me, it's been a practice of gradual awakening. So we each have our own way of waking up to our life, waking up to reality, waking up to what's possible. And whether it's full enlightenment or a partial awakening, you can experience bodhicitta at any moment. The spontaneous, sincere desire to be fully realized and to be present for others in this journey. It might be a moment or a microsecond, but it arises through the conditioning of your heart and mind. It arises by how you incline your mind. And so one doorway or one portal that can help get you access to that, as Pat shared, is using gratitude. When you reflect on what you're grateful for, you can cultivate this inner shift to receptivity and openness and sometimes even a sense of awe. It's impossible to feel anger and gratitude at the same time. It's impossible to feel greed and gratitude at the same time. And another portal, another doorway to access this state of bodhicitta, of awakened mind and heart, is through cultivating generosity. This morning at the 6:45 meditation, I just had this spontaneous remembrance of Tara's mother. And for some unknown reason to me, she really liked me. Part of the early conditioning of my heart and mind was a really deep-set feeling of not being seen and not being heard. And I understand, I've investigated those conditions, and I see more and more clearly around that. You know, I see that my mother was overwhelmed by life, my father was absorbed into his career, and other conditions in my family left me with that sense of lack. But I had a spontaneous feeling this morning of Tara's mother, who was just actively interested in my life. And what a blessing that was. It was kind of stunning and a little uncomfortable. But the active interest and the compassion she had for me just filled me with a sense of a real wonder, a real sense of grace. And it reminded me, toward the end of her life, we kind of like bundled her up in blankets, and she was sitting on her back porch looking out into the woods. And I was heading off to teach my Monday night class in Arlington and ready to do battle with D.C. traffic. But I wanted to check in with her because I hadn't seen her that day, just to check in before I left. So I went over and we were hanging out, and I was kind of chatting away and kind of animatedly talking about something. And she just said, look at that bird. Do you see that bird over there? And I just sort of snapped me out of my story, and like I couldn't see it. And then I saw it, this like little bird on a branch. And then I kind of got back talking about where I was going and what I was doing. And she said, look how blue the sky is. And suddenly it snapped me into like, I hadn't noticed how blue, it was like the bluest sky I'd seen in a long time. And then I started talking a little more about where I was going. And then she said, when I first met you, you were so terribly busy. Has that changed? And so I'm driving down the driveway, and I was like stoned. And I realized I just had a bodhisattva attack. So a little experiment, if you would. If you like, you can close your eyes. You might just take a moment to connect with your breath. And if you would, just take a moment, if you wish, to reflect on someone or something that you find very easy to love or to feel appreciation for or gratitude for. Again, you might start with a pet. And just sense in your own way, perhaps, how easy it is to feel that flow of goodwill. Now, you might imagine whatever benefits you've gained from your practice, whatever fruit has blossomed through your practice, that you could give it freely to this being. And just sense what that feels like on the inside. And now, if you wish, you might do a little role reversal and just sense how this being perceives you. And imagine that this being could offer the fruit of their practice freely to you for your benefit, for your well-being. And just sense what that feels like inside. And in these final moments, just take a sense just to feel this sense of freely offering and receiving what is freely offered to you. And then if you like, you can deepen the breath. And if you like, you can open the eyes or remain with them closed. In that reflection, you may, or maybe not, but you may have felt some, either a loosening or a falling away of the sense of I and me. When we open to that sense of generosity or compassion, or receiving the offering of merit, there can be some kind of a release or some expansion of a tightly held sense of self. This practice or inquiry into compassion, it inclines the mind toward a sense of connectedness. The sense of I and mine can fall away sometimes. And what's interesting now, using functional MRIs, we can actually see what's happening in the brain when you engage into this practice, either willfully or spontaneously. That there are parts of the brain that are being hammered with energy. The insula and the temporal parietal juncture. And this part of the brain, this part of the nervous system, has something to do with sensing yourself as a separate entity. Robert Thurman had this great thing where he said, meditation is an evolutionary sport. That when you practice, you are altering how energy moves through your brain and how you perceive reality. So when you reflect on this week, the hours that you've put in, how many times you woke up out of the narrative from your mind, how many emotions you've surfed, how many waves of physical pain and emotional turbulence and mental agitation you've endured, how many hours of instruction you sat through, 6 hours of Dharma talks. Inevitably, something shifts. And inevitably, there can be some anxiety around leaving the monastery to move back into your commitments, your responsibilities, and your life. In one of the groups, someone was asking about this, and I offered 2 words of advice. Don't go. This is great. One of my favorite New Yorker cartoons is it's Tarzan standing by the door of his hut, and the caption is, "It's a jungle out there, Jane." But if you are going to go, it becomes a question of how can you be in your commitments and responsibilities and relationships and cultivate an unbroken connection to presence. And there's something in here about taking full responsibility for ourselves. I have 2 short stories about fingers. I was with a friend in Iceland, visiting in Iceland. And he told me how he picked up his son at school, and he saw his son was like lecturing these other kids, you know? And he was just waving his finger and talking to them. And he took his son, and he was explaining to him on the drive home. He said, "That's not nice. You know, that's really not a good thing to do." And then later that evening, his son was kind of acting up. And he said, "Listen, you should not be..." And then suddenly he saw what he was doing. And he said he realized that the finger really needed to go like this. So the other finger story I love is from Gil Fronsdal, who was leading a little class for kids on Buddhism. And you know how kids love playing with candles, you know, and running their finger through? So they're all playing with candles. And basically, as they're playing, and I don't think Gil exactly used these words, but he's sort of how he translated in the Dharma talk. He said, when you're holding your finger in the candle flame, at some point, you need to ask yourself, how am I contributing to this feeling of suffering? And we realize, oh, I can remove my finger. And it becomes a very interesting element when you are examining your own sense of dissatisfaction, unsteadiness, stress, and suffering, to really look deep. How are you contributing to your suffering? And this is the practice of the U-turn, of looking back at ourselves. I see for myself and my own practice that when I'm in any kind of pain, there's a contraction. The sense of I and mine become very powerful. They run the whole system. And when I'm in pain, I either get lost in anger or disassociation, or I lose energy, or I'm paralyzed in some way. And the question becomes, how do we wake up out of that pain? Most of us spend our lives running from that clench. And I'm just in awe of the courage that is collectively shared here, of the willingness to turn toward the pain, to get curious, and then to pull out these powerful elements of seeing it clearly and exploring how to access loving presence. And then to observe what happens when these two wings are brought to any given experience. And so, as the Buddha said, no one is going to save you. You have to take full responsibility for your own enlightenment. When I first heard that, it was a little shocking. And at the same time, incredibly freeing. I was sharing in one of the groups today that there really is, for me, this sense, we speak of the two questions of what is happening and can I be with it. Another variation of that for me sometimes is what is happening right now and how does this moment want me to be with it right now? So perhaps, again, a little short inquiry, if you like. You can close your eyes. And you might again notice the breath or notice the vibration of sound and allow yourself to open to receive it. And imagine if the past could fall away. If the future could fall away. If you could forget all the external instructions you've heard this week. And to inquire, what is happening right now? How does this moment want you to be with it right now? And it can be interesting to notice what arises. To notice, to relax, to focus your attention a little more. You have access to deep intuitive knowing. To sense what is here. And to sense how to be with it. If you like, again, you can deepen the breath, and if you like, you can open the eyes. When we look at what it means to take responsibility for our lives, there's the recognition that you are the inheritor of your karma, and that you are the creator of your karma. As a kid, I would often think, this can't be my real family. Someday they're going to come and pick me up. But then a realization, this is it. We realize at some point, these are the cards that you've been dealt. I remember once in a deep inquiry with someone, and part of what they were exploring was the anger that they had trouble controlling toward their kids and how they felt bad about it, but they really couldn't stop it. And as she was inquiring about this pattern, she reflected on this feeling of frustration and her quickness to express her anger and dissatisfaction toward her kids, but also the horror at seeing how it was shaping their characters. And as she was reflecting on this, we did a reflection on how old that feeling was, and it took her right back to her childhood. And she realized that that was exactly how she was treated by her parents. It was controlling through anger and controlling through shaming. And then she realized that that's what her grandparents did to her parents. And then it became a reflection on just how old was that chain of anger and expression and abuse and shaming And she realized that her karmic inheritance stretched back further than she could recall. And when she felt the impact of that, when she really got that the guilt that she felt was part of her inheritance, part of her own conditioning, there was a moment I'll never forget. She was just kind of breathing into this. And then she stopped, and then she opened her eyes with this fierce look in her eyes. And she said, "This stops with me. I am not going to pass this on to the next generation." That's the power of this practice. That's the power of taking responsibility, of recognizing, not denying your karmic inheritance, but actively acknowledging the conditioning, all of it, and recognizing the power of creating. What I love about this practice is that it's not pessimistic, even though we talk about suffering and death and old age and all that stuff, you know. It's not optimistic. It's not just all happy thoughts and think love and everything's going to be okay. It's realistic. This is a practice of seeing what's true. And as you know, this practice is brutal. You come in contact with what is true. And it's about seeing clearly through delusion. It's one of my favorite jokes in the world. This guy goes into a board meeting, and there are a lot of people sitting around waiting for the board meeting to start. And a woman comes in and says, "Oh, there was a clown down on the corner." Another woman looks at her and says, "Well, was it a real clown or someone dressed up as a clown?" So we're trying to see what's true. And part of what we see, of course, is impermanence and our relationship to impermanence. I'm aware of the time, so I'm skipping a poem. Another element of being awake in the world is the willingness to turn toward what's between you and feeling free. In the story of the Buddha's journey, you know, after his awakening, he continued to serve. And when you look at the life and the history of the Buddha, his life was not effortless. There were conflicts around him all the time. There were assassination attempts on his life. He was trying to build a community with inexperienced and uncooked people. You can imagine the challenges from that. There were power struggles within the Sangha. There were wars among family members that he had to step in to negotiate. And he didn't step back from engaging into the conflict. And that's a powerful model to contemplate. In the Dzogchen view, there are these wonderful two lines. "Though my view is as spacious as the sky, my actions and respect for cause and effect are as fine as grains of flour. How can you hold the vastness of things and at the same time attend to the details of your life?" of our interdependent life. So whatever your intention was for this retreat, to fully awaken, to cultivate more love and wisdom, to let go, to learn how to accept what arises, to learn more about the practice and how it works, or to survive, inevitably you've encountered all kinds of manifestations, all kinds of sensations and thought forms that are between you and feeling free. Sometimes you can meet them fully. Sometimes perhaps you had to withdraw because it was too much. I also sometimes in my practice, I flash on that scene from the Monty Python movie where they're running toward the castle, you know, attack, attack, and the next scene is run away, run away. That's part of the practice too. There is a men's group that meets in Washington, D.C. And when they share around a circle, they talk about their AFCO. Someone say, well, my AFCO this week is, and then I'll talk. So it's AFGO. And AFCO, and I'll substitute one of the words, stands for another freaking growth opportunity. And it's a great reframe, of course. Here's another growth opportunity. And it is sort of training ourselves to turn toward that which is difficult. We had a saying in the ashram that I lived in, because part of our metaphor was how difficulties come in waves, you know, how emotions come in waves. You know, you're in equanimity, everything's fine, and then there's this clench. And you begin to clench inside, and you can feel the formation of the wave. You feel the pressure build inside. Maybe there's an emotion that builds. And as that wave builds, that's usually when we want to jump off the wave. And so, of course, we'll jump into anger, judgment, blame, fantasy, disassociation, worry, anxiety, sloth, torpor, doubt, all of that. That's how we get off the wave. But if you stay on the wave, there is some kind of crescendo. And on the other side of the wave, there will either be a sense that some energy has passed through, there may be some sense of release or relief, there may be some cognitive insight, you know, some sense that of something you're holding on to that you're not holding on to, or belief that you're believing that maybe isn't true. But I love that metaphor of riding the wave. So part of how we would coach each other when we'd sort of like feel something coming on would just to say, okay, surf's up. You know, can you ride that wave? I imagine that you have been on many, many waves this week. And it's so helpful and so important to acknowledge the work that you've done. Father Thomas Keating is one of my heroes. And he created Christian contemplative prayer, which is very much mantra meditation, where you select a word or a phrase from scripture that's meaningful for you. And that word or phrase is your anchor. It's what you come back to again and again and again. He's a really, really wonderful person. But I love how his definition, or one of his definitions of meditation, he says that meditation is a practice of consent. It's a consent to God's presence during your time of practice. And here's how he says it in his language. God will bring people and events into our lives, and whatever we think about them, they are designed for the evolution of his life in us. The willingness to consent to what arises. What a radical, radical practice. The third quality is that an awakened being helps create a world of new possibility. When we turn to embrace that which is between us and feeling free, it is the hardest thing in the world to do that. But when we look toward models, those bodhisattvas who have created great change in the world, oftentimes the seed of their work was through a deep wounding. Gandhi was thrown off a train because of his color. His capacity to absorb that wound and to transmute that wound, we cannot measure the impact of his life in the world. For Martin Luther King, it was this deep feeling of the hatred for him, for who he was, for his race, the color of his skin. Somehow, he transmuted that. Again, in a way, we can't measure the impact. Nelson Mandela, incarcerated and tormented by his jailers. How did he do that? It's easy to think that's them, it's not us. But, you know, I see it all the time. In this privileged place I have to be able to be with and work with people who are actively and consciously examining their lives to see how the deepest wounds can be converted into sacred gifts. And so there's a wonderful line, just a few minutes left. Deepak Chopra once said, "If you show me your physical health now, I can tell you what your habits were. If you tell me your habits now, I can tell you what your health will be." That's not perfectly true, as much of our health is genetically based. But what he points to is the power of your actions and how they can affect your future. And it's an interesting reflection. I'd like to close with a little reflection. When you look really closely to what is enlivening you now, to what is lighting you up now, if you were to nurture and cultivate that, that is your future. So let's close our eyes. Short little reflection here. You might just take a moment and, again, just feel the breath. And just a sense in your life now, what enlivens you? What lights you up? What is it that calls you into a greater sense of possibility in your life? And you might imagine, if you were to nurture and cultivate these qualities, and if they were to grow and flower, what would that feel like inside? What would that be like? And if you imagine this future self out there, enlivened and integrated and expressing, what advice would that future self offer you now? You might again deepen your breath. If you like, you can open the eyes. Each one of us has a question that we carry inside, which in some variation of, what is my dharma? What is my work in the world? And I love what the Buddha said. What the Buddha said, finding your dharma is your dharma. Finding your path is your path. And part of your responsibility is to explore the different practices and traditions and all the possibilities. He said, seek fully to find that which most resonates for you. And when you find it, give yourself to it fully. And it's very important that if you don't have that resonant sense of, this is what my life is about, that you honor that you are on your path of finding that out. I think that Ram Dass, in one of his book titles, summed it all up. The book title is, How Can I Help? That when you reflect, how can you help? As a friend of mine said, it's really three questions. What do you love? What are you good at? And what is the vehicle that can carry that forward? And so we're called to live fully, to enjoy this life, to increase your capacity to savor, to celebrate this amazing journey. What a rich inquiry. How much more intimately can you embrace and celebrate this life that you've been given? And how do you serve? How can you serve in a way that you are fully expressed or you are growing and where you can feel that deep satisfaction of contributing? So I'd like to close with a variation of the Bodhisattva prayer by Diane Ackerman. So if you like, you can close your eyes. In the name of the daybreak, and the eyelids of morning, and the wayfaring moon, and the night when it departs, I swear I will not dishonor my soul with hatred, but offer myself humbly as a guardian of nature, as a healer of misery, as a messenger of wonder, as an architect of peace. In the name of the sun and its mirrors and the day that embraces it and the cloud veils drawn over it and the uttermost night and the male and the female and the plants bursting with seed and the crowning seasons of the firefly and the apple, I will honor all life wherever, in whatever form it may dwell, on earth, my home, and in the mansions of the stars.